Hi, Mage fans, this is your host Terry Robinson with Mage the Podcast, and this week I'm trying something I've never done before, a single mic show, which is to say this entire episode is just me talking, which is slightly different from our normal episodes, which is almost entirely me talking, and then a guest, or Adam, or I guess sound effects. But anyway, over the course of Gen Con 2023, I ran a bunch of games of Hunter the Reckoning 5th Edition. I ran these games as part of The Wrecking Crew, which helps run games for Renegade Entertainment, the current team that writes most of the World of Darkness games for Paradox. Why did I do this? At the time, it looked like Mage was going to be the next 5th edition game to be done, and I wanted to be on their radar for when they started staffing up for Mage 5th. When Justin Achille was the creative lead for Paradox, that was potentially the case because of a single mysterious tweet he sent out saying that he had drawn up some notes for Mage with Justin out as the creative lead for Paradox and kind of doing his own thing. I have no idea what's next or what Mage would even look like. Regardless, I ran a bunch of sessions of Hunter the Reckoning 5th Edition because I agreed to, and this resulted in me reading the Hunter material thoroughly, and this is kind of what I learned for it and some of the things I would want to steal for Mage. The core contrivance of Hunter the Reckoning is that you are a hunter, who are characters that have a drive, capital D, activated in them to hunt the supernatural. These drives are curiosity, vengeance, oath, greed, pride, envy, and atonement. You figure drives would be more mechanically core to the game, but they really only determine what you do to end despair, which is the state where you've lost your special interest in hunting, and until you recover it, you lose access to desperation dice, which I'll explain later. And you need to do something to get back in the game. You need to do like a montage or something. I don't know. The two special things hunters have access to are perks, which give them access to special armaments, information gathering abilities, or resistance to the supernatural, as well as desperation dice. Many of these perks are a bit odd in that they last a scene rather than a session. I kind of found it poorly thought out that if I borrowed a armored vehicle to blow my way into a military base, for me at least, preparing, getting there, being at the base, and escaping are all separate scenes, and having the vehicle for one is not super useful. You can roll it for subsequent scenes, but these are frequently difficulty four rolls, meaning you need at least four successes to keep it. Likewise, if I borrow a rocket launcher or something, I figure I'd get it for the day. I don't know. I figure explosives have like a day pass or something. As I mentioned, the activation difficulties for these powers is often quite high, meaning that without desperation dice or willpower spends, you generally have less than even odds to call on the thing that notionally makes you special. If you're the guy with the armored car, you should just have an armored car. That's my opinion. Maybe you need a roll to get it repaired, or if it's something truly special, if you want to go from armored car to Bradley fighting vehicle or Abrams tank or something like that, that's when you have to use the dice. The other special event you get as a hunter is desperation, or access to desperation dice. Desperation is a ballast mechanic, whereby whenever the group faces a setback against their quarry, which is the target of their hunt, the desperation value increases. Then, based on one's creed, which is the approach you take to the hunt, you can call on these extra dice. The creeds are entrepreneurial, faithful, underworld, martial, and inquisitive. As the hunters succeed, the danger level can increase, which is a different thing, and is a semi-mechanized way of kind of tracking tension and how onto you the quarry is. Danger also increases if you roll a 1 on a desperation die and don't choose to automatically fail the roll. Danger also increases if the cell gains an edge on their quarry. This results in a certain kind of careful planning, not netting an advantage if the danger level is just going to go up anyway. You may say, at danger two, security systems are harder to hack. And at danger three, the quarry has a bodyguard. And at danger four, a contact of yours is threatened. And at danger five, the safe house is attacked. Little guidance is provided on what each level should do, and calibrating this versus desperation dice kind of determines how tense and punishing your game will be. Theoretically, the danger level can go up to an arbitrary number, but we only get examples up to five, whereas desperation can only ever get to five. Additionally, danger only ever increases generally until the quarry is taken down, and desperation is something that can go up and down as the storyteller chooses. Other than that, there really aren't any special systems besides what we get from Vampire 5th Edition. Mind you, the V5 core system is pretty tight and moves along nicely. There are no botches, and any 10-sided die showing a 6 or greater is a success. Additionally, each pair of 10s is 4 successes. This pairwise mechanic results in a larger dice pool being more than proportionately better than a smaller dice pool. So 8 dice is more than twice as good in terms of raw successes as 4 dice, because you are more likely to have a 10s collision, which is useful. So, some conclusions. After running some 15 hours of the game, I realized a few things. Hunters themselves are pretty uninteresting. Like, the game provides little help with making the world more interesting. You need to be thorough and your NPCs and antagonists deep and your players potentially smart to piece together a game. There is no clue mechanic. There's a breakdown between investigate and act, which results in the latter generally having many more opportunities to use desperation dice. The perks, creeds, and stat array all want to be lined up in the same direction or your powers will misfire, so you kind of have to pile on what your character does to specialize in something. This isn't a Hunter the Reckoning game. This is a Hunter's Hunted game, just without Numina or True Faith. I was a little familiar with Hunter the Reckoning, so to compare, I cracked open Hunter the Vigil 2nd Edition, and I literally took 10 random pages from each book. So I would open one book, and then I would open to the other, and each to a random page, and I'd say, which one of these games seemed more interesting? And in 8 out of 10 cases, the Hunter the Vigil 2nd Edition book just seemed more interesting on that page, with kind of more options and such. This could also certainly be personal taste. I will say the writing in the book is quite good, as is the artistry. Anyone who says illustration is dead should look at this book. The text moves and the graphic design is sharp and readable. The fact that it's black and white with just kind of splotches of orange-yellow is gorgeous and striking. The game also makes choices that result in some odd scenarios. I mentioned losing your van in the middle of using it. And if you're like the group's researcher, you're not really going to get access to desperation dice. So I hope you didn't pick that creed, because generally your research abilities are going to be used early on in the game to kind of give you a lead. But the game also wants you to live in the shadows, where you never know what something is about. This results in scenarios, for instance, where your special dagger of vampire stabbing gets a bonus against vampires, but you never actually can truly know if something is a vampire. Like, no one has detect vampire. You just have detect supernatural, and that just kind of feels weird. This ambiguity is something we could theoretically use in our games if we wanted to avoid kind of falling into tropes. Now, some things I would kind of steal for Mage. I think desperation is a perfectly reasonable mechanic to act as a ballast mechanic, a la Momentum in Story Path games, or the creatively named Momentum as part of the 2D20 games. If you're running a Monster of the Week game or something similar, each time the group faces a major setback, the desperation dice pool increases. Characters can call on this based on their role in the group, based on paradigm, or whatever you want. Instead of it being a permanent die, each setback could instead add 3 dice to a pool that are removed once that die comes up as a success. So not quite a one-shot and not quite permanent. Danger is an interesting mechanic with little guidance, but it does serve as a way to trigger when a storyteller should probably act, a la the storyteller moves in Powered by the Apocalypse games. Sometimes it's not obvious when an antagonist should act, and danger level answers that question. In previous games, we might wait for a botch for that to occur, but danger is much more tied to character action. Some people may recoil against this to have such a straightforward and kind of stylized way to increase the hazard of a chronicle, where other people will take it as a breath of fresh air to know when, as a storyteller, I should increase the tension. The final two areas where I'd want to steal for Mage are organizations and weird night folk. In this episode, I'm only going to talk about the orgs. Orgs are organizations that generally will be opposing, or at best will be in a love-hate relationship with the Cell, which is to say a group of hunters. They do not have drives. They cannot call on desperation dice. And their motivations are almost entirely self-serving in some way. They are secondary antagonists, or the word I just learned, contagonists, and they may want to steal your stuff, take credit for what you've done, remove you from the field, have you not investigating what they do, and all sorts of other things. And there's kind of some key themes that run through it. One is that people are selfish. Anyone engaged in an org in a position of power is either in it for themselves or is crazy. Orgs want to perpetuate themselves. This may now be an outgrowth of point one, where people in charge always want to expand their resources, get more pay, increase their head count, or gain administrative clout. A hunter cell would be fine if all vampires disappeared, whereas the head of blank body investigation for the SAD would rather they not, at least in the world as presented in Hunter. The third theme that was very strong in this book is governments are fundamentally authoritarian. Your response as a listener may be, duh, but orgs as portrayed either want the idea of a menace to be known paired with the idea that only they can protect you from it, and only if you follow their rules. They're strange beasts in the forest, and our police need your money and authority to do whatever it takes to stop them. But also, if you're out after curfew, anything that happens to you isn't our responsibility, especially if you're a hunter. You could say the real beastmen are the figures of authority that abuse their grant on sanctioned violence. The flip side of this is that the government doesn't want reports of supernaturals getting out, not because they don't want to frighten the populace, but because any evidence that the government knew about a problem would demand accountability. Discovering that a chaos scope that can detect ectoplasm costs $11 billion to develop, and ectoplasmic rounds exist, and my community is still being terrorized by a poltergeist, could lead me to ask, where my tax dollars really going, and is it worth it? So we get some information on the types of orgs. The orgs are broken into types, and this framework helps understand how to use them. Mind you, if you're using this in a mage game, you'd likely need to modify them to make them either a threat or an impediment or something with which your characters will interact. Every org can represent a tool to be used by your characters, a complication that pops up to make the Chantry's life more difficult, or possibly an ally if you want to play a less adversarial world. The first type is academic. This type of group views information as a tool or a currency, and they hoard both types of information. Members of these orgs have some inclination towards a religious background. This is just kind of lightly hinted at. Their antagonism comes from wanting the information your group has and knowing you'll pay a high price to get what they have if it's useful. The scholars of Hakim possess an early text of a group of West Asian vampires who revere their founding figure. You know that the text is a strong sympathetic link with every vampire of that lineage. What happens when the only thing they want in exchange for a copy of this is In the Shade of the Black Sun, a noted primer that seems to produce a disproportionate number of marauders? Maybe your Chantry library is intermixed with a college's rare book archives. Normally having such materials open to academics isn't a problem, as it may take many lifetimes for a sleeper to understand them, but the academic org, the Kensington Bookworms, are just looking to flat out steal it. Do you spend the resources to fortify the library? Do you void a point of the library background if they are able to steal it? Do you do something to permanently scare them away and kind of appear on their radar? Academic orgs ask the question, at what price knowledge, and then what do you do with it once you have it? The orgs in the game answer this question with price high. What do you do with it? Use it to dunk on other academic orgs and to show that you're cooler. The next type are corporate orgs. They tend to be stable and well-funded, with an interest in monetizing the hunt, the process of finding supernaturals. They are private military contractors, often with a supernatural remit. Many of these are outright frauds. A wandering ghost may startle a community, the community may contact someone they heard works with such a problems, and after deploying a few tactical crews at significant expense to the community, the ghost moves on and Ghost Co. collects the consulting fees. Corporate orgs may be uncaring about collateral damage if a security contractor has been paid $60 million to bring down a lupine for investigation. They may be unconcerned about using kinfolk as leverage or using your Custos family as bait. the latest mortal that your chantry pissed off may not have been just any executive, but the founder of Infocon, who's paid Allied Securities quite a bit to investigate and return the strange woman with a nimbus of blue sparks that erupted from her before his car was flipped over one night due to her attempts to escape from some black suits, suddenly requiring some vulgar magic. Your chantry may trust its sleeper sentries, but does it trust them not to take a $500,000 cash bounty that Allied Security is offering just to leave the door unlocked and unguarded on one particular night? Corporate orgs may be looking to productize the supernatural. Your chantry may learn that a new security contractor is claiming to have rounds effective against unusual threats. Maybe they do aggravated damage or they simply ignore armor. What does the chantry want to do when they find out they're simply mundane high-caliber rounds with a slight tracer effect to them and no other supernatural effects on it? Do they leave it be or do they intercede? Because at some point, someone's going to try and use these rounds to protect themselves from a ghost and it's not going to end well. Corporate orgs pit personal ethics versus corporate ethics when you're interacting with them. A chantry without extensive resources may use a corporate org as a source of money. The characters form a front company that is a subcontractor to the firm, which gives them a jump on supernatural activity in the area. Maybe you close out vampire contracts, but just kind of ignore the fairy ones. And what happens when the org discovers that you're maybe just not some private military contractors with a background in the occult? The next org type are governments. Even in the world of darkness, no nation's constitution likely includes a mandate to tackle the supernatural. The occult is hidden, and as are efforts at dealing with it, or so the logic in this game goes. Government orgs are often effective when they choose to act, but may possess an internal tension between an attitude of supremacy and those who dislike their reactionary use of power. Government orgs have the benefit of being able to invoke the jus gladii, the right of the state to kill. They are also territorial and are loath to share information. Ultimately, how you choose to portray a government org is up to you, but Hunter advises that government orgs work best either as a clock the characters are up against or when there is a maze of internal interacting orgs. If the characters aren't able to deal with the supposed darknet devil that is killing residents of a large town, the local mayor is more than comfortable to blame it on the growing immigrant community, setting off a wave of unwarranted arrests, shuttering many community businesses and breaking families apart. Government orgs can also serve as the nexus of bureaucratic horror. The chantry may have received tacit permission to break into the warehouse at the edge of the city to investigate a rogue alchemist whose research projects may be affecting a town's water supply, causing strange dreams that tap into Malinus' dream realm of the dreambound. When the cops arrive, the characters find out the warehouse is actually just over the municipal line in a different jurisdiction with no love for the police chief that you have a pardon from, and that chief's devil-may-care attitude seemingly towards breaking and entering. Government orgs in V5 are presented as capable and potent, but misguided or adversarial. This is a break from previous editions where government orgs may know something, but they were often internally compromised or just didn't have the resources to deal with anything. So this is interesting to see kind of the direction these entities are taking in the fifth edition. The penultimate group we get are religious orgs. Religious orgs represent religious groups that have some community power and influence and use it to take a fight to who they perceive to be the enemy. Theirs is driven by purported divine rather than secular power. Religious orgs can also function as a cover for other types of organization who may choose to wrap what they're doing in religious trappings to conceal what they're doing and as a way to gain legitimacy. You may have a group that purports to be investigating angel sightings, but their ultimate goal is to capture one because they heard that angel feathers are quite useful as a drug. If you're playing in an M20 frame, religious groups are more likely to have noumena to call on if you want to have that in your game. Religious orgs can function as a cap on the chantry. A local church hears of pagan activities and their signs start displaying, "Do not suffer a witch to live." A botanica store run by an East Asian herbalist sorcerer then has their business and home torched. The apex of this is the entity of the Vatican with access to 2 millennia of experience and a sense of zealotry that makes the Ascension War look quaint. If you're not familiar with the entity, that is the term for like kind of the Vatican Secret Service. It appears in V5 as a more emergent and extant threat. Further complication comes from one of the characters being a member of the faith community in question. How does Brother Reinhard protect his flock when his flock is choosing to claim devils exist, and it turns out two of the accused are legitimate Cainite? Religious orcs present to mages an opportunity to see what paradigm looks like in the heads of sleepers. Remember, religious orcs are small groups within a religious community, and they generally don't represent the religious community that they come from. The Sisters of St. Teresa is dedicated towards slaying restless ghosts, but their methods involve trapping the ghost in a living vessel from among their group and then killing that person, who they then revere as a martyr. This kind of brutal summoning and slaying is thinning the veil, making the problem much worse. Does the Chantry intercede, or do the mages simply let the sleepers do what they wish? Final group we get information on are vigilante orcs. Vigilante orcs contain mortals who know about the supernatural and want to hit them hard. Vigilantes see a lack of societal safeguards against the supernatural, and they wish to take back the night. Vigilantes may have Procrustean solutions, having no issue setting on fire a warehouse district to destroy a single vampire haven, or putting a chemical weapon into a spring to destroy a cairn, even though it will pollute the local water table. A vigilante may be driven to simply know that they were right. A vigilante may be comfortable torturing a town councilwoman to get the evidence they need that the county commissioner is a diabolist. When they later dynamite the courthouse and the green flame rises with the death of the diabolist, the destruction and death may be worth it to indulge the vigilante's sense of satisfaction. A pair of vigilantes both have friends lying in coma due to a particularly brutal type of fairy rhapsody, where the creative drive of a human is consumed to gain power. Every gallery owner and art teacher is now a potential target as they wage a war to stop those who would try and control art. Vigilante orgs are interesting in that they kind of shine a light on the extremism that may be inherent to a hunter cell and may represent either a line of this is something we cannot cross, or alternatively, we can, it is just that we believe our cause is just, whereas the vigilantes themselves are misguided or something like that. We get several specific orgs, examples of those above. So let's talk about a few. The first is Special Affairs Division, which is a division of the U.S.'s Federal Bureau of Investigation and has been brought back as an organization riding a wave of authoritarian tendency in the U.S. They demand compliance and dominion over anyone who has had notable interactions with vampires, and they are very specifically concerned with vampires. And they pass everything off to their sister org, the IAO, the Information Awareness Office. Adam and I discussed that in Project Twilight. Maybe the character's magic is viewed as obviously vampiric power, and it draws the eyes of Special Affairs Division. Maybe this places their families under observation as they too are now suspected of being vampires. Maybe the Chantry can prove that they're not vampires somehow, but Special Affairs Division will only let them off if they admit to being some sort of Renfield-type ghoul, and they need to provide their sire to escape. Now the Chantry needs to find a vampire of significant power to produce for Sad to be happy. Ironically, Sad may be better equipped to deal with the local whomever more so than the mages. They are highly specialized against vampires, and they know what they're doing. If you are not playing a US-based game, the Coalition, which is a kind of umbrella organization of many governmental militant orgs, contains a number of national groups as well as religious groups such as the Society of Leopold or La Entita, First Light, GSG9 in Germany, JTRG in the UK, HSP in Egypt, and TID in Japan, along with a half dozen other that are listed in the book. The IAO is raised from a smaller org to being a military org using military methods. They're listed as being wired into the National Security Information Apparatus with algorithmic methods to raise alerts. This organization has been pummeled with allegations of human rights abuses and is constantly at odds with other agencies. The IAO may be one of the few mortal orgs that just puts the pieces together and figures out what your Chantry is doing. Maybe cell phones have gotten bugged, the Chantry is under surveillance, and there's no hint of the technocratic union's involvement. Do the characters flee off the grid? Do they seek aid from a technomantic group who may be able to counter these technological threats? Or do they try and redirect the attention elsewhere? It is somewhat unique in Mage to have a mortal organization that can just kind of figure out who you are, possibly. The Arcanum returns and is only lightly changed. They are rich, well-appointed, informed, and very dilettantish. Benjamin Holmescroft has been replaced by Morag Holmescroft, and no one is quite sure what their relationship was. Sandeep D'Souza of the New Delhi Chapter House was passed over for the role of Grand Chancellor. Anat Osmond is currently digitizing the archives of the Cairo Chapter House, which has become quite a hot restricted sector in the digital web. The Arcanum has money. Maybe while investigating a return Hunlun dragon in Nova Scotia, the Arcanum hears of this and sets up a colony and quickly buys up all the evidence of the creature in the area, making magical investigation a bit harder. Any attempt to intervene will be viewed as Claude Murray of the DC's Chapter House meddling, getting the characters involved in the internal politics of the Arcanum, or alternatively putting a mortal contact at risk. Monster X is introduced as a company that outfits monster hunters with anti-monster technology. A small amount of it works, but they support a framework where you can be your own boss and fight the supernatural. Make sure to use their products when doing it. So Monster Hunter X has a franchise model where you become a licensed contractor with them and buy their stuff to set up your own monster hunting business. Where possible, franchisees are given significant rewards to bring in supernatural items to fuel research, but often at great cost and with questionable results. Their franchisees are unaware and barely understand what they are up against. Maybe Monster X has been stealing your tasks, knowing it's special, but not really sure what it is. Maybe they've created quintessence spray that they think repels ghosts, but in reality just attracts minor spirits. The Order of the Rose is a religious group that views cleanliness as the road to godliness. They join suburban communities and through societal pressure and through amazing graphic design convince others to join and make their house and relationship with God as clean as possible. Characters called Blooms do the work of maintaining rigid social order in co-opted communities and prompting group participation in Order of the Rose activities, while the Thorns use more brutal methods to deal with issues in the community. The Thorns are quite effective, and some communities join the Order simply to be under their aegis and to deal with what they believe are supernatural threats. Again, this setting does not presume that mortals know what the supernatural are, but it does suggest that some people know that weird things are going on, and certain people seemingly know how to deal with them. The Order is a wonderful antagonist as it shows all the signs of a supernatural mind virus, but nope, it's just suburban peer pressure. We also get a peek at the Orpheus group, which is a little more mad scientist than the other groups. It's presented as a group trying to run before it can walk, and from the view of Mage, this really isn't a change. One thing that comes to mind is, what if the Orpheus group, which has figured out a way to project, which is access the underworld by either having a near-death experience or going into cryonic storage, were instead exploring another place in the other world? What if there were a group that figured out how to break out of dream bubbles in the Maya and stumble into adjacent dreams, or found their way to the Vulgate of the High Umbra? Maybe they find someone who nightly dreams of destroying their old office complex, with each iteration of the dream being a little more realistic, and your mages need to interact with these mortals to try and track it down. We also get a number of international groups, including Brazilian law enforcement, and a Philippine group where prisoners can get money and reduce sentences to provide backup to law enforcement efforts against the supernatural. I don't know how true to life these are, so I really am just not commenting on them. One of the recurring themes of orgs is the question of the flow of power, knowledge, privilege, and safety, and the people at each level that choose to fight against the status quo in the World of Darkness. In the X5 World of Darkness, the presence of the supernatural is considered the status quo, making hunters transformational heroes. They go into the world and affect change, and in turn, they themselves are changed. This echoes common themes in Mage, where when one pushes against reality, reality pushes back and leaves its fingerprints. Overall, these are interesting themes, but this is up against a background of kind of dying quickly and a lot, with no mechanics for really character replacement or a benefit that you accrue when your character dies. This makes me think of a weird mage-hunter mashup game where avatars get a certain amount of time in the world until they return to their source and are stripped of most of their memories. In Mummy, we get the Ba stat, which measures one's natural life force. In its first go, an avatar may start with an avatar rating of 10, where it is strong-willed but weak in magic, having little experience of mundane reality. Maybe every decade or after extreme stress, it drops a point. As the avatar works with a mage, it may pick up spheres, advantages, and backgrounds, and has more memories tied to it. As the avatar slowly loses life force, though, it gains power. And as this avatar moves from mage to mage, it kind of clearly makes up a lineage, but kind of on a shorter term timescale than what we often see in mage. So Lewis awakens in his 20s to a newly returned avatar. The avatar is primordial essence and takes on the form of rain. Lewis interprets this as a drive to purify the parts of the world of darkness that have been tainted. The avatar is new and remembers recently being united with all magic, and Lewis awakens with an arete of 3 and is even on the cusp of a 4th point, but is unfamiliar with the laws of reality and has only 1 dot in each of 6 spheres. Lewis has a 5-point avatar, but the avatar provides few other benefits. Lewis gains some familiarity with life and entropy, seeing the two sides of life and death. Over the ensuing decades, the avatar and Lewis confront the Nafandi and learn much of their dark plans, until Lewis meets his end in his 40s trying to destroy a call. Lewis's avatar disconnects in his last moments of life as the mage says, "Go continue our work." The avatar departs and finds a young girl, Aliana, having just crawled away from a collision with a drunk driver. That suggests the kind of determination the avatar is looking for, and Aliana's awakening is filled with images of the call, filled with suffering and madness and dark cancerous growth. Aliana's first act of magic is to staunch her own bleeding until an ambulance can arrive. The avatar, during this moment, recognizes the drunk driver as a low-level agent of an active Sinistratus with an Afandi, and causes the heart monitor he's hooked up to by the ambulance team to malfunction. He flatlines, and the machine continues to report all is well until it's far too late. The area gets washed with a sweet rain, the avatar feeling it has done good by its previous host, Lewis. Our new magus, Aliana, awakens with an arete of 2 and 2 dots in life and entropy, in addition to a dot in mind and correspondence. The previous experience with Nafandi imparts the new host with the ability to smell of Tass's tainted resonance just by interacting with it, and a dot of destiny representing the avatar's drive. On successful seekings, the new host learns her role in killing the drunk driver, which she is not okay with. She doesn't know who the Nafandi are until the storm that is her avatar manifests a soft melodic voice to provide additional guidance on future seekings. Aliana chooses not to fight the Nafandi directly, but to protect the communities they prey upon. Over time, without her knowledge, the avatar directs Aliana to a minor wonder Lewis had discovered, as well as to a sputtering node that every once in a while provides a point of quintessence. Maybe in its next host, the avatar comes to blows as the new host cares not for mortal communities and simply wishes to seek ascension or to flee to the Umbra. Maybe the avatar's essence changes to pattern after a few lifetimes of fighting the Nafandi until it tires of it and becomes questing to finally gain ascension so it can kind of depart this world. Over successive manifestations, it becomes more articulate and talks directly with the host, even outside of seekings, but it knows now that its time is short, as its total amount of kind of avatar energy is depleted. It is highly knowledgeable but weak. In its final host, the avatar is 0 point and can only interact by kind of leaving notes around. It remembers little of the nature of magic, but knows much of many spheres, granting its host sphere depth status in 2 spheres and a second affinity sphere. What does it choose to do in its final lifetime? This separation between the avatar and the mage lets a player have an avatar over several characters as it gains awareness, and we see serial conflicts between the avatar and the mage. The avatar itself isn't always sure what to do. Is the avatar a free agent, or is it just carrying on the fights and grudges from a previous host? Is this like a cell that is merely carrying on the supernatural grudges from the previous members of the cell? Maybe in this kind of game, every 5 sessions you have a new character but the same avatar, picking up in terms of previous mystical form where the previous mage left off. This would create potentially apocalyptic awakenings as a sleeper suddenly finding themselves with a former master's avatar, and they must quickly learn to harness its magical power or likely be destroyed in the process. A less avatar-centric version of this game would be a world where mages spend significant time creating tomes, wonders, primers, and sancto with significant geesh on them, making it so they are only usable as long as the inheriting mage keeps up their war against the kindred, Garu, specters, or demons. Easy power may come to a mage willing to spend more and more time on their hunt, and bands may form around it. What happens when a character wishes to break away? Is fulfilling your duty to receive power worth enough to be something you potentially die for? And these are kind of the takeaways I had from Hunter in terms of theme. Again, I think the organization's orgs are pretty interesting, and the sample versions of supernaturals it presents are pretty interesting. I am saving the discussion of those supernatural creatures for a different episode, where I talk with someone about kind of remixing Nightfolk. But tell me what you think. This is the first single mic episode I've done, and I can either do the second half as another single mic, or I can do it with a co-host. Tell me your thoughts, discord.me/MageThePodcast. This has been Mage the Podcast, where we only fall into despair if no one listens. This episode is made possible by the oracles of various orcs, including Sean Gallagher, Oracle of the FDA, who wants to use lupines as high-powered threshing machines. Ben Bendelo, Oracle of the 4-H Club, who instead thinks lupines could be a great show species. Buck Gregory, Oracle of the Sierra Club, looking to harness the power of fairies to save endangered lichens, or something. Christopher Phillips, Oracle of the Toastmasters, who want to use the power of fairies to instead captivate audiences in new ways. Guy Stewart, Oracle of the Gilda Radner Fan Club, who hope that their idol has been preserved as a vampire and will kill any number of bloodsuckers to find her. Josh Hillerup, Oracle of the Quebec Esperanto Society, who wants to see if vampire bites can transmit knowledge of Esperanto. Pukuji, Oracle of the Barbershop Harmony Society, who investigates controlling ghosts with catchy four-part men's groups. Jay Widener, Oracle of the Cloud Appreciation Society, who wish to know when they're appreciating true cloud and not just ghostly ectoplasm. Mikhail, Oracle of New Mexicans for Science and Reason, who wish there were no mages because that really complicates a naturalistic worldview. The crew of Erebus, Oracle of the National Association of Underwater Instructors, because, it's just obvious. Also, thank you to Archmaster Andrew Edelstein, Archmaster Brad of the Blue, Archmaster Bubba the Pale One, Archmaster Dan Svensson, Archmaster Derek Semsick, Archmaster Jason Vines, Archmaster Leroy Bryce, Archmaster Morgan Aran, Archmaster Nathan Weaver, as well as Alex, Alexia, Ambiversion, Anders S., Anon, Baderfi, Birdo, Blaze Hibbert, Blake Ryan, Brandon, Bryce Perry, Chris Blake, Sin Shotis, Daniel Cuppen, Daniel Scribner, Darren Hennessy, David Roy, Dennis Osborne, Eli Levenger, Eric Schwenk, Frager Rock, George Lara, Henry Kraft, Ia Bolt, Jason Kennedy, Jason W. Briggs, Jake Gatsby, Jenna Brin, Jenna F., John Magnuson, Jolene Andes, Lulz and Stuff, Joshua Heath, Kathleen Halperin, Chris Kinner, Leslie Weatherstone, Matthew Proyle, Michael Creedle, Michael Parker, Nathan Weaver, Nibero, Neil Patterson, Nikita Klamenov, Oliver Schindler, Patrick McNamara, Patrick Mulder, Rachel Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, Robart the Robot, Ryan Stray, Rob H., Ryan Kendi, Samuel Tobin, Starfish, Stephen Carton, Thrice Great, Vincent Hamilton, Walter, William Connolly, and William Martin. Our EP shout-out to this week is to Leroy Bryce, whose name Leroy means the king. In this case, the King of Bryce, which I assume means he's the mayor of Bryce Canyon National Park. Bryce Canyon National Park and I share a birthday of February 25th, and I was negative 56 years old when it was started in 1928. The park is often listed as being discovered by John Wesley Powell, but also the park notes that the Anasazi, the Fremont, and the Pauti tribe moved around in the area for thousands of years. In that the park is 36,000 acres, I'm going to assume that they saw it first. Bryce Canyon has easily one of the most jaw-dropping sunsets I have ever seen, to the point where the first time I saw one, I pointed at the purple on the horizon and said to my passenger, "See, that purple doesn't exist in nature. This is photoshopped." Also, Bryce Canyon is not actually a canyon, but a collection of natural amphitheaters. It's also the smallest national park in Utah, which has a lot of national parkland, and on the whole, I think this is a pretty good use for Utah. Leroy, thank you for your support. Rather listen on YouTube, search Mage the Podcast on YouTube to find our full library there. If you super like this episode or super didn't, drop us a line at magethepodcast@gmail.com or at magethepodcast on Twitter. We have a Hoppin' Discord community at discord.me/magethepodcast. Mage the Podcast is also at Mastodon at dice.camp/@magethepodcast. Podcast. If you like us, please give us a review on the platform of your choosing or tell a friend about us. Also go to magethepodcast.com for show notes and all of our previous shows. Now go change reality. Bye.